Welcome to End of Life University Podcast, where we share real talk about life and death. I'm your host, Dr. Karen Wyatt, and I want to thank you so much for joining me here today for another episode. This is number 387. Wow, I'm getting close to that magic milestone of 400 episodes, and I'm really thrilled about that. Today, in just a moment, I'll be sharing with you a conversation I had with Dr. Ira Byock on how to save hospice. Dr. Byock and I discuss the article that was published last November in ProPublica and New Yorker called Endgame, How the Visionary Hospice Movement Became a For-Profit Hustle. And so we share our thoughts and ideas about what it's going to take for hospice care to get better and improve from the place it is right now. And Dr. Byock talks about an essay that he recently published in Stat Online called Hospice Care Needs Saving. So stay tuned. I think you'll really enjoy this conversation. Before we get started, I want to thank my newest supporter on Patreon, Sarah Perry. Thank you, Sarah, for signing up and helping to contribute to keep this podcast on the air. And if you're interested in knowing more about that, you can go to Patreon, patreon.com/EOLU, and there you'll find out how to join the team and make sure we can keep going with this podcast and make it at least to 400 episodes and hopefully far beyond that. I also want to remind you that I have a YouTube channel, which is also named End of Life University. If you're someone who likes watching videos on YouTube, you can go there and you'll see the videos of all these conversations that take place, my guest and I. And so, again, that's End of Life University on YouTube. And I also wanted to remind you that I have another podcast called What Really Matters, Everyday Spirituality. And last week's episode was titled, Are We Going to Die or Not? And I just talked a little bit about the sometimes confusing messages about death that you can read on social media. So I just wanted to mention that for any of you who haven't listened to What Really Matters. And as always, for both podcasts and for the YouTube channel, it's really helpful if you subscribe and also leave ratings and reviews for the work that I do. I appreciate that so much. So now we'll move on to my conversation with Dr. Ira Byock. As always, stay tuned afterwards and I'll come back with a few takeaways and to say goodbye. So here we go. Today, I'm so happy to welcome back my return guest, Dr. Ira Byock. And if you've listened to this podcast for a while, you've met Dr. Byock before since he has been a regular visitor to the podcast, but I'll just read a little bit of his bio for those of you who aren't familiar. Dr. Ira Byock is a leading palliative care physician, author, and public advocate for improving care through the end of life. He is emeritus professor of medicine and community and family medicine at the Dartmouth Geisel School of Medicine and a past president of the American Academy of Hospice and Palliative Medicine. His books include Dying Well, The Four Things That Matter Most, and The Best Care Possible. And you can learn more about Dr. Byock at his website, irabyock.org. So Ira, thanks for joining me once again today.
It's always a pleasure to be with you. Thanks for asking.
Well, I've been excited to talk to you because we decided that we would dive in to the rather devastating article that was published in ProPublica and the New Yorker back in at the end of November, called How the Visionary Hospice Movement Became a For-Profit Hustle. But Ira, on our last conversation, which was in June of last year, you and I talked about what keeps me up at night, and we actually covered a lot of the same points in that discussion. So this article was not really a surprise to me. And I wondered what your initial reaction was when you saw it come out.
Well, the article was distressing, to say the least. It was different than our conversation, but there are overlapping issues and problems. The The journalist Ava Kaufman's article in ProPublica and New Yorker really delved into instances of outright fraud in hospice companies. She did, Ava Kaufman did focus on for-profit companies, mostly in the South, but also Southeast, but also in California and Texas, that really have highly questionable practices, and in some instances, just outright fraud. What has kept me up at night, though this, you could add this one to my anxiety closet, because people are, you know, falling prey to these really fraudulent enrollment practices and screening practices and the like. But what we had spoken about is the really wide variation of quality in hospice care, which is something that, you know, is somewhat associated with the for-profits that clearly act somewhat differently, but is a problem that spans both for-profits and non-for-profits in hospice care, and is really difficult for people to determine, you know, what's good, what's excellent, and what's merely mediocre. And that really worries me a lot.
You know, I've been reading lately that 60% of people in surveys nowadays complain about healthcare in general and the quality of the healthcare they're receiving. And so it seems to me that there are issues in all of healthcare around quality and how we care for patients. It's not just in hospice, and there are issues with short staffing and a lot of problems like that that lead to some of the lack of quality. So I don't think this is just an issue that affects hospice. I think we can look much more broadly at all of healthcare and realize we have problems within our system.
I'd say yes, and there are problems across the health system, no question. I think some of the same themes that are affecting hospice care are active within the general health system, you know, profit motive being a big one. And the impact on hospice care over even the last, you know, 5 or 8 years has been devastating. I have witnessed, and I think we've spoken about this, I'm guessing you also have witnessed, a real deterioration of quality. And a lack of being able for me to say to people, just make sure that your mom or your aunt or uncle gets hospice care. Now, for the last handful of years, I've had to pause and say, but also make sure that hospice care is worthy of caring for your aunt or uncle or, you know, parent.
Yeah, I felt the same thing. And I'm such a huge advocate of hospice. I absolutely love hospice. I love the mission and vision of hospice, and devoted my life and career to it, as you did, Ira. And so I've been the biggest proponent for hospice until, as you said, recently. And it's not just what I hear from nurses and doctors within the hospice system. I hear it sometimes from patients and family members who have had a bad hospice experience, and that really concerns me. And I feel crushed that we're at this point. And yet I don't really feel crushed that this article was written, partly because I think it's very important to call attention to it and bring it out in the open. And that's the sense I got from the op-ed that you wrote called Hospice Care Needs Saving.
Yes. So I wrote an article several days later, and it came out in STAT, the online healthcare zine. You know, I had been working on since June. I've been doing interviews with various colleagues and nurses and physician colleagues, some administrators, long-term administrators, as well as some patients about their experience with hospice and some of the trying to tease out some of the trends that have led us to this predicament that we're currently in. And I just simply repurposed a longer essay I was writing after the ProPublica New Yorker article was published. What really took me back and really was alarming was that the initial response from hospice associations nationally was defensive, kind of attacking the journalist for the way she crafted the article and being really kind of in a defensive crouch. We're misunderstood. Here we go again. We're being victimized. And I thought that was 180 degrees wrong, because while the article was not perfect, it was far more right than wrong. And even if it was 10% right, we who are the providers of hospice care need to be contrite and committing to protecting the public from bad actors and committing to excellence. And that was not the first response. It was not the first response of the National Hospice and Palliative Care Organization, where I think I'm a founder and have worked very, very closely over the years. And even more disturbing to me, it was not the initial response of the Academy of Hospice and Palliative Medicine, which was just not okay. So I have gotten active and have remained active. I think there's a path through this, by the way. I was less hopeful in June when we spoke than I am today. I've been working on this consistently since that time. And I do think that there's a hopeful road ahead, but healing starts with admitting there's a problem. And man, we have a problem. And to say, to attack the journalist is really not a courageous stance.
I completely agree with that. I mean, that's something I would say I've learned over my life, is that you have to be willing to look within, and you have to be willing to look at your own shadow if you're ever going to grow and make things better. And I feel like that's so important for organizations as well, to be able to just take stock of what's happening. And some people said, oh, this article is going to cause people not to choose hospice. But actually, what will cause people not to choose hospice is when their neighbors and relatives say they had a bad experience with hospice or got taken advantage of. So really, if we want to protect hospice, we have to look within and figure out how can we improve the situation and make sure that people have a good experience when they do choose a hospice.
Correct. Yes.
So one issue that I think about all the time, I mean, we know that hospice's reimbursement system from Medicare of the per diem is one thing that's being exploited in some ways by fraudulent companies. And do you think we need to change the reimbursement system, or do you think we can keep it as it is and create more regulations in order to help to manage the fraud?
Any step we take needs to be taken carefully, because there is danger in almost anything. Let me unpack what you asked. For one thing, the current per diem reimbursement system is more than sufficient to provide excellent hospice care to people. And so while I have long thought it ought to change, it needn't change to provide excellent care. What's happening today is that there is, kind of profiteering within hospices. Again, it's more exaggerated, I think, in some of the for-profits, particularly some of the private equity for-profits, but there's profit motive is pernicious across tax statuses of hospice programs, and I think it's reflected in cherry picking of patients, picking patients who are more remunerative, are gonna be on service longer and cost you less money on a per day needs basis. But then it's also reflected in staffing. And if your expenses are lower, so you have less nurses particularly per patient, but also less physicians per patient, you're going to make more margin. The margins being reported by hospices, I think the average is over 6% for nonprofits and 19% or more for for-profits. It is plenty sufficient to provide well-staffed programs. And I think, you know, if I, well, we'll get back to this, but I think the path forward, if we didn't change the reimbursement structure, the path forward would still allow hospices to make a significant positive margin while staffing up and attending to the needs of the patients and the families they serve. Because concurrent palliative care with curative care or disease-modifying care works better than forcing a terrible choice of one or the other, because concurrent care works, I have long thought that the Medicare, for instance, reimbursement model ought to allow for concurrent care and actually encourage it so that patients and families' needs are met, they have higher quality of life, and particularly we have prevented crises that bring people to the emergency department and cause, you know, unplanned hospitalizations, which we know is not good for anybody, right? It's far more expensive. And the last place that seriously ill people need to be is in the hospital. People, there's bugs in there that can infect you, and there's things that happen. You can fall and you're not going to sleep as well. Everything's going to go bad, right? So keeping people out of the hospital by using concurrent care really makes a lot of sense. These days, I worry about the carve-in. You know, there's a lot of talk about as we move toward value-based care and global budgeting for putting people's total costs of care within a Medicare Advantage program, for instance, carving hospice into Medicare Advantage, I really worry that what we're going to get is a very diluted ersatz hospice in name only product. And I think those of us in hospice, and I'll say the same thing about palliative care, non-hospice palliative care, ought to be moving very swiftly to very carefully define what we mean in quality parameters and then in regulations about what would be delivered within a carve-in situation. I don't know why we're not doing that. Maybe it's being done at an HPCO or elsewhere, but I haven't seen the drafts of that. And it worries me a lot that what would have been success from my perspective a few years ago could end up being kind of, you know, heat death of palliative care, meaning, you know, you'll get hospice or palliative care within the Medicare Advantage benefit, but you will hardly notice anything happened, and it won't be excellent.
So it does seem like, and I think you wrote about this, that we need to kind of shore up the structures that we're using around hospice, the guardrails in a way, and the regulations. Yes. We need just stronger accountability for hospices. It seems like that's been lacking for a long time.
Yes, and there's you know, articles in the peer-reviewed literature that shows that that the hospice programs aren't being surveyed consistent with the Impact Act of, what, I think, 2015 or 2016, that had every hospice surveyed every 3 years. But even when they are surveyed and deficiencies are found in over 50% of the cases of hospice programs that are surveyed, there's little sting to being out of compliance with conditions of participation. So, you know, it's not good. There does need to be much stronger accountability. I think our data reporting needs to be much stronger. I mean, I can't find a data set that reports what a hospice program's average caseload for nurse managers is. And yet that's what I want to know. That's one of the key parameters I want to know for choosing one hospice program over another. How many, you know, we mentioned it already in this conversation, how many patients each hospice physician is responsible for, normalized to a 1.0 full-time equivalent physician, right? I know anecdotally of hospice programs that have one certifying hospice physician for 200 or 300 patients. Well, on its face, that's absurd and bad quality. And, you know, and yet there's no way for a referring physician to know that when he or she chooses a hospice program to recommend to their patients. There's no way patients or families can know that. That has to change. And that really could be a very easy fix. It could be done as a, not as a regulation even, let's say the National Hospice and Palliative Care Organization or a new consumer group just invited hospice programs to start listing current data on average nursing caseload, average physician, hospice physician caseload, you know, time to respond to after hours emergency calls, you know, amount of, well, we'll just start there for the moment. Even that, even those few data points, hospice programs wouldn't have to respond to that request for information, but you and I, as either a referring physician or a family member who might need hospice care for a loved one, could go to that, and I wouldn't choose the hospice programs that chose not to contribute data, right? I would choose among those who were proud enough to report their own data.
Yeah, that's such a good point, and such, I agree with you. It's a doable solution. And I was thinking about the fact we talked about in our last conversation, the fact that hospice started as kind of outside the box, outside the traditional sphere of medicine, and later was brought in into medicine. But I think the expectation has just been goodwill. You know, everyone trusts the hospice providers because, gosh, they're doing such good work to care for these patients at the end of life. So that not enough questions were asked, and maybe not enough of these guardrails were created in the very beginning. And now that lack of regulation has been exploited, it is up to us to try to correct it. And as you wrote, to win back the trust of the general public for hospice.
Right. To earn back the trust, really.
Earn back.
I mean, we have to demonstrate that we can do this. And we ought to invite inspection, in all honesty. We ought to be transparent about our hospice programs' performances, comparative performances. This is not easy, and like staffing these days is incredibly hard. I'm not trying to minimize that at all, but it matters. And if it's transparent, we're going to work towards something that has a direct relationship to quality. Again, I don't know why our field hasn't done this for ourselves, frankly, 25 years ago, in all honesty, but we need to do this now.
And Ira, something I'd like to hear your opinion on this, something that I witnessed happening when I was working for a hospice, and I mentioned last time it was a nonprofit hospice that was bought out by a for-profit hospice, but we had a director who was a longtime hospice nurse and RN who understood hospice, you know, the heart and the essence of hospice so well. But she got replaced by administrators who were all MBAs who knew nothing about healthcare, for one thing, but absolutely nothing about hospice care. Not the first thing about what it's like to take care of a hospice patient. And suddenly there was such a gap between administration and the providers of care that we could not really even have productive conversations anymore about how to do business. And I just saw a huge shift there. And those administrators with their MBAs, they were coming in to run hospice like a business. That was what they were hired for, to turn it into a business and make it a successful business. I can't fault them that they didn't know anything about hospice, but I just saw a real breakdown there in communication and a loss in some ways of the mission and the vision that we had had previously. And I don't know if you've witnessed that as well.
I have witnessed that repeatedly. And I'm going to emphasize here. I want the for-profit hospice programs to succeed. I really do. I am not against for-profit hospice care. I am against bad care. I want the for-profits to succeed by delivering truly excellent hospice care. And while I do think that there is some culpability that the for-profit movement, if you will, if there is, you can speak of such a thing, but the trends of hospice for-profits becoming dominant, which they have, they're now 70% of the market, and like something like 11 or 12% are private equity owned or publicly traded for-profits. I have seen that even excellent for-profits that are wholly owned, started by owners who are passionate about hospice care, once they go through an initial public offering, an IPO, and become publicly traded, within a couple of years, and sometimes within months, the culture changes within the organization, the passion somehow goes, and what you get back are, frankly, a lot of professional management that isn't immoral, but it's kind of amoral. It's really focused on return on investment, productivity and efficiency, which, you know, as I said in my op-ed, is often just a euphemism for profit. Mm-hmm. And I've seen that happen again and again and again. Nowadays, there are a lot of nonprofits, particularly large nonprofits, that are run by those same MBAs, mm-hmm. Who are looking at productivity and efficiency, and it sure as heck feels like the business environment that we're both concerned about and is different than where we started.
Yeah, and it makes sense, because when there are the nonprofits in community with the for-profits, they're competing with one another. And in order to stay afloat, exactly, the nonprofits may have to take on the very same business practices. I mean, in my heart, I question, like, should caring for people who are dying be a business? Does that make sense for it to be a business at all?
So now we're going back to where we started, where we started with your point is, you know, in the United States of America, it's really hard to say that any healthcare needs to be nonprofit. And I've had to absorb the notion that hospice and even palliative care, some segment of it is going to be for profit. Some segment of it is going to be publicly traded and even private equity owned for profits. I'm not happy with that, Karen, but I acknowledge that that is the reality and will continue to be the reality. And so I want to help them to the extent that I can be a consultant or an educator or a public advocate. I want to help them succeed, but they need to succeed through providing reliably excellent hospice care.
Exactly. And I did want to go back to the point you made earlier about concurrent care and how that, I think, is a potential game changer in many ways. Because if you think about it, as you said, the awful choice a patient is given, do you want to keep seeing your oncologist and this entire medical team who's been caring for you for several years now on this journey? Or do you want to go to hospice where you'll lose all those providers and take on someone completely new that you've never met before, and you're not sure you trust what they'll do for you?
Right.
It doesn't make sense.
Right. And the way it comes out by well-meaning, compassionate people, I'm not trying to make fun of them, but what the patient and family not uncommonly hear is, do you want to continue to keep seeing us and have us working on your heart disease and you're getting better and coming to the clinics and having your whatever we're doing for you, your delbutamine rinses or your amiodarone and you know, seeing the team here? Or if you feel ready to give up, we can send you to this wonderful program, and they're really lovely people, these hospice people, and you're going to just love them, right? That's the terrible choice. Why don't we do this both? While we continue to do everything we can to get your heart stronger, and you feeling better and maximizing your comfort and quality of life, we'd love to bring in this team that's what they do day in and day out. And they're specialists, not in heart failure as much as in just people's comfort and quality of life and their function. And there's a whole team to support you and your family going forward. How's that sound? You know, like, can we start today? Right. You've heard me rail against saying we provide care, the best care possible at the end of life versus we provide the best care possible through the end of life. Mm-hmm. Because if I meet you and say we provide the best care possible at the end of life, you know, it's not uncommon that people say, well, that sounds great. Nice to meet you. We'll call you when we get there. But we ain't there yet. If we provide the best care possible through the end of life, you know, that sounds terrific. Can you start today?
But then, right, since palliative care can offer that same quality team-based care right now,
right,
concurrently,
right,
do we need hospice? Is it possible that palliative care, I mean, do we, that's what I struggle with in my mind. Do we need a separate organization called hospice, or do we have a palliative care team all the way through?
I think there are multiple ways to deliver the best care possible through the end of life. And one is concurrent palliative care, where that palliative care then extends into a home-based service from the same team that's been providing you palliative care during the last 3 years, right? Or whatever, however long it is. Part of that is by creating medical homes where the clinicians, whether they be primary care clinicians or heart failure clinicians or whomever, have the primary palliative skills of communication and anticipatory guidance and goal alignment and symptom surveillance and symptom management, so that specialty palliative care is not needed at least as early and maybe not as often as it is now. But you know, there are a number of ways to get there. And reforming the Medicare hospice benefit is one way. Carving it in when it's not ersatz, when it's really genuine interdisciplinary, you know, hospice care, concurrent perhaps earlier than it currently is in the disease trajectory, that too can work. I mean, there are any number of ways to do this. And it needn't be that complicated, because we ought to be able to pretty swiftly define patient and family experience or deliverables of service that allow for flexibility in the delivery models, right? Where at the end of the day, you're getting what we would define as really good whole person care through the end of life.
And that makes sense since every situation is so unique depending on the diagnosis and the amount and type of care each patient or family might need. It makes sense we need this flexible system that can,
right,
can cover that spectrum.
What the challenge we have today, this is going to kind of bring us back to where we started, is right now we don't have trust. I don't have trust in providers. I don't think the public has trust. And the ProPublica New Yorker article by Ava Kaufman really clearly showed that the most vulnerable patients in our healthcare system are currently at risk, significant risk, by a by unscrupulous hospice companies. And it's not trivial. They're not rare. That's disheartening. And it makes kind of this notion of letting a thousand flowers bloom and just let's track the outcomes to make sure that people are getting, it makes that really a risky stance to take because we don't have trust.
And therefore the statement, oh, it's just a few bad actors, which is sort of a way of shoving it all under the rug. They're just, you know, in every organization, there are a few bad actors. So taking that stance, which I read from the NHPCO, is that is just a little bit naive in a way. And that doesn't fix any kind of problem if you try to just shove it aside as, oh, just a few people are doing the wrong thing and that will always happen.
It's not naive, though, because they knew about this. The organizations knew about this for years. I have been putting this in front of them, but I'm not the only one. It's not about me. But I have been raising this behind closed doors in private conversations and as well as, you know, in educational sessions and various conferences for years and years and years. And they know it. I mean, it's being discussed quietly. The statement that this defensive statement about the ProPublica New Yorker piece was utterly irresponsible. I can't say otherwise. It's just not, that was not the right thing to do. There is a path forward, but it takes saying you're right. There are too many bad actors within our midst. And we need to take corrective actions. We apologize for the public for putting vulnerable people at risk. And we're going to recommit to getting this right. That is the only response that has any credibility.
Yeah, exactly. Well, one of my concerns right now is hospice teams already have been short-staffed, especially nurses and home health aides. And I just don't know, how do we correct that? How do we attract more people to want to work in hospice at the point we're at? I don't know if you have thoughts about that.
You know, recommitting to quality would be a place to start. Policing ourselves. One way to increase the pool of hospice nurses out there is to decrease the number of unneeded hospice programs that are hiring nurses out there. I mean, there's 1,000 hospice programs in LA County, right? Probably 20 would do, right? So there's that. We may need to pay hospice nurses more. But I also would say that when you staff up hospice physicians, for instance, in a hospice program, you already alleviate everybody's stress because we're an interdisciplinary team. You know, you can cover absences for, you know, somebody, you know, breaks an ankle skiing and they're out for, you know, 4 weeks, right? If you've got a full interdisciplinary team, you can absorb that and cover his or her responsibilities in a better way. You can spread the load. Right now, we have endemic short staffing across the interdisciplinary teams, which means that, you know, you can't absorb the load. And what suffers is quality of patient and family care, right? Again, there's enough margin I'll just speak for hospice physicians. There's enough margin within the business of hospice care to make sure that interdisciplinary teams are well staffed by hospice physicians who aren't just doing this as a hobby, but are doing this as part of their practices and have and understand what their clinical and ethical roles and responsibilities are. And oh, by the way, what their responsibilities are as determined in regulation under the hospice conditions of participation.
And when we see physicians making fewer patient visits in some hospices, you know, not seeing all the patients and making fewer visits, is that a product of simply too many patients for one physician to care for? Or are physicians being discouraged from seeing the patients actually?
It's both people, you know, hospice physicians, not uncommonly, and there's wide variation, and I don't want to, there's plenty of excellent programs out there, but it is now quite common to find that hospice physicians are hired with the expectation, usually explicitly stated during their interviewing and hiring, that they will be seeing very few patients, if any at all. That their responsibility is to review charts, to be part of IDTs, the interdisciplinary team meetings, and to certify patients, making required face-to-face visits only for certification and recertification, and supervising maybe nurse practitioners or physician assistants. And even that gets diluted because the interdisciplinary team meetings, instead of being at least once weekly, are now every 2 weeks, which is the minimum required by the conditions of participation, and they become pretty perfunctory reading of the patients who have died since the last IDT or who have been admitted and are having problems. So many patients never even get presented because they come on and off service in between interdisciplinary team meetings. And, you know, and as I wrote in my op-ed, it's not uncommon for the hospice medical director to be so stretched that he or she can't even attend the full interdisciplinary team meeting. This is unwholesome. This is not. So when things are that short-staffed, the stress on the hospice nurses becomes higher because there's not a physician who knows the case, who you've spoken with, who you've got a close, really collaborative practice relationship with, and who can respond like that when there's a problem and you need the doctor's help. That it's we're so interconnected that it's hard to discuss the impact of high caseloads on one discipline in out of context of the other.
And for me, when I hear that, that's just crushing because I have to say the interdisciplinary team meetings were, I thought, the whole heart of what we did in hospice. The fact that we came,
right?
That we came together and shared our ideas. And then also for me, as a hospice physician making home visits to patients, even in the very beginning when I didn't know anything. I mean, I'd been trained by the nurses on our staff. I didn't know very much, but I could make a visit to the family, and it engenders so much trust for the family to know there is a doctor who cares about us, who's hearing all this information and talks to the nurses and the home health aides and knows what's happening. And so simply the title of being the physician, that alone made a difference. And so those visits, I felt, were crucial in terms of our team being whole and presenting to the patient and their family that you can trust us because all of us are here looking after you together. And to be missing those physician visits, I can see how things could so easily fall apart.
Yes, and do. You know, recently I've been doing interviews with some of our hospice physician colleagues to try to better understand this situation in hospice care today, because it has changed a lot over the years. And I had a wonderful animated conversation with a longtime hospice physician who said, told me that, you know, he said, I absolutely demand that I see every patient I can see and review the chart carefully. And he said, I can't tell you how often I find patients who have been referred who haven't had therapies that I know are available for their underlying cancer or heart failure or other condition. He says, it's not a rare occurrence that I see somebody and I I'm the one who calls their doctor and said, have you thought about this therapy? And I'll talk to the patient about it. And the patient, you know, decides to go back and have a novel therapy that hadn't previously been considered or discussed. Said, you know, so I'm doing work that basically benefits the public health in a way that doesn't even reflect in hospice statistics. But similarly, you know, we doctors bring a different perspective. And sometimes for me, you know, I'm an old ER doc. And for me, it's really important that every hospice patient has an individualized crisis prevention and crisis management plan, because I just am so aware that things go bump in the night. Mm-hmm. And if you've already thought about it and made some provisions for it, boy, things just go a lot easier when urgencies occur.
Yeah, and it's just, you know, that obvious rule that more heads involved in the care will make it better. More of you coming together with different perspectives, different experience. Yeah. We even have different relationships with the patient and family. We hear different stories. Sometimes they tell us things they don't tell the nurse. They tell the volunteer something they don't tell anyone else. That's why
I think the IDT is where the magic happens. I think it's not just that the disciplines add to one another. There really is a synergism. I'm not being too new age or woo woo here, but there really is something about the whole being more than the sum of its parts when you can collaborate creatively around the care for a patient and family. It's just different. And so I also, losing the dynamic, creative collaboration of an interdisciplinary team meeting is, I think, is part of a real danger to hospice care today.
Yeah. Well, one thing I wanted to ask you, do you think the fact that, I mean, I don't know, is it a failure on the part of hospice, or is it also that CMS, which pays the Medicare benefit and per diem, has also maybe not provided enough top-down regulation and supervision? And do you think it's a product of rejecting the idea of death in the first place? So let's just shove hospice over there and let them do whatever they do, and we don't want to think about it.
In a funny way, but not because they kind of diminish the value, but they almost feel like it's too sacred. And so I think there is a little bit of resistance on the part of regulators to overmanage hospice care because, oh my God, they're doing God's work and we should leave them be and not and trust them to do what they do best. So I don't think it's ill-intended, or it may have been in the 1960s or 70s a kind of a diminished regard. But I think, if anything, it's the opposite now. But it's still not good. We do need more regulation. I think even more, we need to step up as a field and police ourselves and set standards for ourselves. What one of my colleagues calls the, you know, good housekeeping seal of approval, you know, criteria. Why are we waiting for Medicare to do that? I have been saying this, by the way, since 1997. Why do we need Medicare to set quality parameters? It's our field. Let's develop and publish quality parameters. Like what, you know, and then invite programs to contribute their data to see where they score on this good housekeeping, you know, seal of approval. Like, why do we keep asking for congressional action? In the wake of the ProPublica New Yorker piece, I can't tell you how many people I've talked with, and some of them, you know, are, you know, recognized leaders in our field who kind of say, well, Ira, we've been working with Representative Blumenthal, or we've been working with, you know, this person or that person in Congress, and we really need Congress to act. And I have to say, I say to them, oh dear, I can't tell you, whenever there's a major problem and the solution is we need Congress to act, my heart sinks.
Yeah. Good luck with that.
You know, because, yeah, first of all, good luck with that. And second of all, it's going to take 2 years. And by the time Congress gets through with it, with the lobbyists for all of the different stakeholders here, it will be so diluted. And it, you know, it will be it will be far less useful than what we hope today. And then it will have to be implemented through regulations, and then there's going to have to be oversight, and here we are again. And could we not do this ourselves? I mean, really. It just seems like it's a dodge. I can't do this, but I can go to another meeting with a congressional staffer. You know, well, oh my gosh, come on, guys. Can we pull up our pants and just do this?
Exactly. And let's not be victims. And let's also not be overly idealistic about, oh, the sacredness of hospice. No one, how dare right. someone criticize us? We're so offended.
Right.
Let's throw all of that off. And maybe, Ira, well, I mean, I appreciate that you've been having these conversations with people, because I'll say this, it seems like you're the person we need who's, you know, one step removed, in a sense, in a way that you can see all of this clearly, because you're not working in the middle of it, in a sense, you know, right now.
I think I have a good position to kind of lean into this, partly because, yeah, I don't answer to anybody these days but myself, but also because I really was active in hospice care since the late 70s, and I have watched all of these developments and these trends, and you know, understand that while there's not been ill intention, we've gotten ourselves into a predicament that is pretty far from where we started.
And, you know, if hospice could be self-correcting in a way, what a great role model and example that is for other areas of healthcare that also have some issues that need to be worked on and need
Absolutely.
To be fixed.
Absolutely.
And we can't wait for somebody from the outside. So someone from the outside doesn't even understand what these issues are really about. It does have to come from those of us who've been right there in the trenches and can see pretty clearly the history and how this happened. And so I just want to thank you for your courage, for writing that, the article that you wrote.
Thanks.
For one thing, I've been a little bit scared. Like, do I speak up about this? What do I say? Because, you know, it's taking a stand that maybe not everyone will appreciate, but I'm just grateful for you for using all of your knowledge and experience to try to make things better still.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate your kind words. I'm going to stay in, you know, leaning into this. I'll be quite active going forward and want to keep this. I do think that the New Yorker ProPublica piece really has been a wake-up call. We've been critical earlier in this conversation about the initial response from the organizations. I particularly distressed by the Academy. It has changed. I and others, including other past presidents, pushed back really hard on the Academy leadership, and there's been a shift. And I think there is an openness to say, you know, ooh, we could have done better, and we need to do better going forward. And in addition to working with Congress or trying to get other things, there's some remediation, corrective actions that we can take within the field. I also see that at least an openness to discuss it at the National Hospice and Palliative Care Organization, though I think it's a harder organization. They're providers, and they're pulled by their membership, their sponsors, and their members who are provider organizations who are most troubled by these public exposés of the problems within hospice care. So, but even there, I frankly am hopeful that that there'll be an acknowledgement that long-term success requires recommitting to absolute excellence in the services we provide. I hope so.
I do find this encouraging. You know, as we said after our last conversation in June, we talked a lot about problems, but didn't have a lot of ideas right. about solutions for the problems. But in some ways, maybe this article has catalyzed this more creative approach to thinking our way through what do we need to do next and what can we do from within instead of waiting for something external right. to change this.
That's my sense. And I'm not sanguine about our success. But I do recognize that there's a new opportunity here, and I'm trying to make use of that as much as I can.
Yeah. Well, this has been a great conversation. I honestly was afraid I would come away feeling depressed after we talked, but I feel, you know, I feel positive and I feel excited that there, as you said, there is a path through this. It's going to take some work and it's going to take a lot of integrity and soul searching. Yeah. Yeah. To do that. But well, I'm excited to be here to support you. So, you know, if you want to be my recurring guest and come back again,
hey, do I have the top frequency at this point? I hate to tell you,
but Barbara Carnes, after our last conversation, became a recurring guest coming every other month. So she has like outpaced you. You're the second.
Man. Really distressed about that.
Guest. Okay. I know it's this is a new goal for you to work toward, but anytime you want to come back on and talk.
Well, thank you for having me. You're very generous.
Let me know. Yeah, it's very, very nice to talk with you as always.
By the way, if our listeners have hospice stories that they want to share, good, bad, or ugly, I would love to hear them. It's very helpful to have stories to illustrate some of the trends and some of the data that is out there. So I'm easy to get in touch with. You can get in touch with me either through the irabayok.org website or just direct email, ira.bayok@gmail.com. I'm interested in hearing your stories.
Oh, that's wonderful. You're right. Stories move the needle faster than anything else and get attention. So great. I'll encourage listeners out there to get in touch with you and share their stories.
Thanks. Thank you, Karen. It's a delight to see you.
Thank you, as always.
Bye for now.
I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Dr. Ira Bayok. As always, I really love talking with Ira, and I really appreciate his thoughtfulness and even his optimism about this subject matter, because frankly, I've been feeling a little bit discouraged and worried about whether or not we can salvage hospice from the situation that we're in right now. And so it was a great conversation for me. I was really happy to hear his ideas and also his enthusiasm for making some changes in the future. I hope you feel that way as well. So I want to remind you that if you enjoy this content, please be sure to recommend it to other people who also might benefit from listening. And you can send them a single episode, or you can show them how to subscribe to the podcast on whatever platform they happen to have available to them. And I really appreciate that word of mouth. That's very helpful as we're trying to increase the number of listeners and spread the word to a larger and larger audience about what we need to do to make the end of life better for everyone. So until next week, when I'll be back with another interview, remember that we're here for love. So face your fear, be ready for whatever happens next, and love each and every moment of your very precious life. Bye-bye.